Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record program number 564, titled Interview with John Loftus, subtitled He Who Tells the Truth Gets Chased Out of Nine Villages. This program is being recorded on August 13th of the year 2006, and once again, it is my pleasure and privilege to bring back to our airwaves John Loftus, a man who's not only a scholar, but somebody that I consider to be a genuine American hero. John, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Well, thank you, Dave. It's very kind of you to say that.
Well, it's true, and I'm sure that you're not making millions and millions of dollars because your efforts here. The subtitle of the program, He Who Tells the Truth Gets Chased Out of Nine Villages, is an old Turkish proverb, and as someone that tackles the subject of the Middle East and Islamic and Arabic fascism, I get a lot of that stuff. Let me just very briefly preface the discussion from my own end of things. I get endlessly accused of being a Zionist, unquote, which I'm not. I am basically supportive of Israel, although it's not unqualified. I should note that I have in the past done programs about the fascist element in the Zionist movement, and because of that, I was one of the focal points for my old archives on audio CD duplication service was the focal point of the ADL spying scandal. So in response to those who would chase me out of a 10th village with the oft-repeated cry that he's a Zionist, unquote, perhaps that my credentials would be somewhat burnished by that. Anyway, John, there has been a lot going on in the Middle East. There are a bunch of things I wanted to talk to you about. Are there any things, before I get to sort of my agenda and things I'd like to chat about with you, are there any subjects of importance that you would like to broach, first of all?
Yes. I have often been accused of being pro-Zionist myself, but it should be noted I'm on the board of a lot of Muslim organizations, even though I'm Irish Catholic. But on March 4th through 7th in the St. Petersburg Hilton in St. Petersburg, Florida, I'm having our next intelligence summit, which is a worldwide conference of the intelligence leadership from the free countries. And one of our five or six tracks is going to feature the secular Muslims. The silent majority, if you will, of the Muslim world, a voice that has not been heard. And we want people to understand that what they think of Islam that comes out of Saudi Arabia and stuff is a heresy. 300 years ago, when Wahhabism was founded in Saudi Arabia, it was declared as a heresy more than 60 times by 1900. After 1900, the Saudis got rich, and their heresy suddenly became respectable. Now, the terrorists glom onto the Saudi heresy, Wahhabism or Salafism, as it's sometimes called, and they use that heresy to say this is what Islam requires, and no one's speaking against them. Well, we're going to be speaking against them. We're going to try and rally all the secular and moderate Muslims in the world to come out and say, look, these guys have hijacked the Quran. This is not what this is about. By the way, this conference is open to any U.S. citizen. We do invite foreign people as well. Go to intelligencesummit.org, and you'll see it's one of the most interesting conferences you will ever attend.
Yeah, well, I will second that, the endorsement, and also put a link on my website in the description for this. I wish I could have attended the last one, but I've never been able to give up the day job. I tried it, and I almost starved to death, so I have to keep working the day job.
Yeah, there is that problem.
Well, I don't get sick days, and it's just really nice to be able to put enough food on the table and a roof over my head, and it just... Unfortunately, I was unable to get there because I can't give up the day job or even a few days of it. But it's something I've noted, and I also want to thank people who've been supportive in that regard. Now, John, one thing, you know, we were talking about Wahhabism. This might perhaps be jumping the gun a little bit, but something that perhaps you could enlist the assistance of some of your Muslim associates, as if being a Holocaust denier and a proponent of the international Jewish conspiracy canard wasn't enough. Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany, after a recent communication from Iranian President Ahmadinejad, stated that she felt that... not only was the Iranian position virtually identical with the position of the German extreme right, meaning fascists and Nazis, but she compared Iran today with Germany in the 1930s, which if you or I said it would be a firestorm.
I say that repeatedly. It's 1937, and this time Hitler wants to get nukes. This is exactly what the Iranian regime is about. It is not unfair to call it a fascist regime. In the classic sense, the fascists or corporatists, as their polite name is on, were those. Remember the Roman symbol, the fasces in ancient Rome? It was the bundle of rods all tied up. Well, the rods, the sticks of power, if you will, are the corporate leaders, the guys with the big bucks. Fascism is being ruled by an oligarchy without democratic sanction.
Well, I'd like to get into some of the economic slash political implications of Islamism in a second, but one of the questions that I had, Ahmadinejad, in addition to being a Holocaust denier and all sorts of other wonderful things, somebody who is not only acquiring nuclear weapons, but is also publicly called for the extinguishing of Israel, but he's also an exponent of something called the 12th Imam or Hidden Imam.
Oh, yeah. He's a religious fanatic. There is this weird subcult within the Shiite faith. Now, the Sunni faith has enough weird things of its own, like Wahhabism.
Mm-hmm.
On the Shia side, their religious extremists believe in a hidden imam, a five-year-old that was killed hundreds of years ago and who will come back to life, but only if certain conditions take place. And the conditions are that barking dogs will speak, one-third of the human race has to be slaughtered, there's a catastrophic war for dominance. The people who follow the hidden imam are, you know, those who call for an all-out world jihad.
What's interesting about that to me, is that all of Shia or is it a subgroup in Shia?
Subgroup of Shia. No. The people that the 12th imam group are, you know, a tiny subcult.
Oh, okay.
People don't have to take this stuff seriously.
Well, I was wondering about that because, you know, on the American side, one of the things that makes the whole situation vis-a-vis Israel and the Arabs so very much more complicated, that there is a right-wing Christian fundamentalist element that supports Israel, but because they see this as the end times and they want to bring about the War of Armageddon in which half the Jews get killed and the other half either convert or else they get killed too, and then Jesus comes back.
Sometimes the right things get done for the wrong reasons.
But what's really scary is to consider, you know, an apocalyptic right-wing Christian element on the one side and an apocalyptic Shia subgroup element on the other side, the whole mess spiced with nuclear weapons and both philosophies entailing the wiping out of the Jews.
No, it's that's not fair. That's moral relativism. The Christian fundamentalists are passive. They would never play a hand in causing the deaths of Jews.
Oh, yeah. No, I didn't mean that, but
the
in that they
would
see it.
The ones who intentionally slaughter them are the hidden imam wackos.
Oh, no, and I didn't mean that they want to do that, but they see this as the fulfillment of prophecy, which I find scary in and of itself. You know, but anyway, no, that is an important point to make. So it is not all Shia that have the 12th Imam thing, the hidden Imam thing, because I was wondering about that.
Subgroup. You know, people got to put this in perspective. 85% of the world's Muslims aren't even Arabs, okay?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the 15% that are Arabs, only 1% or 2% are these extremist groups, Wahhabis or Salafis or Diabandis, whatever you call them. Now, the other, next to the Sunnis, the non-Arab groups, there is an extreme cult. The Shiites, which is a pretty moderate cult, actually. I shouldn't call it a cult because most Shias are moderate, reasonable people. They're very feminist and pro-science, pro-education. But there's this weird little subcult even within the Shias in Iran that is just fanatically dedicated to a religious war.
Okay, because I was wondering, the whole hidden imam thing was new to me, and I was wondering if that was, so
yeah,
it's just a little subgroup.
Shias in Iran and probably 100 million Shias worldwide, and about 100,000 of those, of the million would be, of the 100 million would be, you know, people that would go along with the hidden imam.
Uh-huh. Before we get into some of the discussion of what's been taking place in the Middle East, John, there was something that I heard you talk about on the Coast to Coast AM show some months back, and you mentioned that there were indications that the petroleum companies themselves were actually backing the insurgency, as it's called, in Iraq, for monopolistic and pricing reasons. Do you feel comfortable going into that here?
Yeah, a bit. It's... I don't want people to think that, you know, Exxon is arming the insurgents to kill American soldiers.
No.
But Exxon is pleased that the turmoil continues because the prices stay high. Exxon is not an American corporation. Exxon is a multinational corporation.
Mm-hmm.
Its loyalty is not to American people. Its loyalty is to squeeze the American people to pay as absurdly a high price as possible for gasoline. These are not our friends. None of the multinational corporations are our friends. I'm working with a group of people. We're trying to set up something tariff-free oil to support those companies that make a policy of not buying Middle Eastern oil from states that support terrorism. And there are a few that do that. And we're going to see if we can give them some publicity and some encouragement.
So is this an organization that has formally coalesced, or is this something that's sort of informal at this point? Because if it ever
There's
developed...
There's a website up now called Terror Free Oil.
Okay, that's what you anticipated my question. I'm going to put a link on that. We'll talk about that.
Yeah, one of my good buddies, Alex, is behind this and done a lot of research. And the idea is if we can raise about $1.2 million, what we want to do is buy one gas station that sells nothing but tariff-free oil. Now, we pay the same amount of money as you would for any other barrel of oil, but we think the consumers will flock to this station just to show their support for, you know, companies that don't buy oil from, like Sinclair, for example, does not buy oil from the Middle East.
Does Sinclair still exist?
Yep, a lot of states have it.
Really? Because I remember they, as a little kid, I used to see, they had the dinosaur, and I was a big dinosaur buff as a little kid, but out here, I haven't seen it.
No, they're still around.
Good. Well, then it's not a dinosaur in that, in the commercial sense. Excellent.
There's four companies like Sinclair that make a policy of not buying from the Middle East. And I just think it might be fun if we American consumers supported them.
Absolutely. Well, that sounds like a really good thing for people to sort of... put in their mental hopper. Instead of putting a tiger in their tank, well, they might want to put a brontosaurus in their tank.
There you go.
Okay.
Now, of course, you can never guarantee that the actual gas that goes in your tank didn't come from the Middle East, because all oil is a fungible good. It flows back and forth. Mm-hmm. What you can guarantee is none of the profits will go to a Middle Eastern nation that supports terrorism.
Excellent. Well, that sounds like a very worthwhile, practical thing that people can do.
I have very practical, worthwhile friends, and I'm really proud of this one. Just one of my little projects I'm working on.
Now, I'll put a brief one of the few really nice things about what I do is I have some wonderful professional associates and friends who've just been invaluable, and I consider myself blessed in that same regard. John, you and I have spoken many times, and I've spoken at even greater length in other broadcasts about Islamic fascism, about the Nazi roots of many of these organizations, like the secular PLO, like the Muslim Brotherhood and so forth. Recently, I've become aware of a number of photos, some of which are on my website, some of which will be on the website, where a lot of these groups, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, Hamas, and now, above all, Hezbollah, they use the Nazi salute. And yet there's been very little discussion of this.
That's because they were originally Nazi organizations. And people, you know, laugh and roll their eyes. What's the great joke going around now that the Alaskan pipeline was put down by Islamo-fascist caribou, according to the Bush administration? You know. But the sad thing is that there has been such a cover-up of real history. Just as there were German Nazis and Eastern European Nazis, there were Arab Nazis, led by a group... called the man's name was Hassan al-Banna, and he corresponded with Hitler as far back as the 20s. By the 30s, he was the Nazi Party's favorite Arab, even more popular than the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. But he created the Muslim Brotherhood, sort of an espionage service in the Arab world for the Third Reich. They had 500,000 members. This thing was huge. And so the Muslim Brotherhood during the war, they promised to Hitler that there wouldn't be a single British soldier left alive in Cairo by the time that Montgomery reached the city.
Mm-hmm.
They had underground armies everywhere. That, in fact, Saddam Hussein's uncle, the man who raised Saddam Hussein, was a Nazi and led the Muslim Brotherhood coup in Iraq during the war that was quickly suppressed. These guys were vicious, they were thugs, they were, you know, Nazis in Arab costume. They had the same ideology when you think about it. They hated Jews, Western culture, and democracy.
And Hamas, I would note, and Palestinian Islamic Jihad are direct offshoots of the Muslim Brotherhood.
You're so right. That's not even a close relative. These are direct offshoots. Osama bin Laden's right-hand man, Dr. al-Zawahiri, his Egyptian Islamic Jihad was a splinter group from Muslim Brotherhood, so was Sami Alarian's Palestinian Islamic Jihad, so was Hamas, and on and on and on. All of the Sunni-based terrorist groups are direct descendants of this Arab Nazi party, the Muslim Brotherhood.
And both Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad use the Nazi salute. Now, Hezbollah is southern Lebanese Shia backed by Iran.
Right. The Sunnis the Muslim Brotherhood, the Shia are backed by Iran. But there's a bridge between the two. Professor Alarian's Palestinian Islamic Jihad group makes the link between Sunni terrorism and Shia terrorism, and so the Iranians now are supporting several of the Sunni-based groups. So what's happening is you're finding a union of the theological extremists of Iran with the old Islamo-fascist groups of the Sunni groups from the rest of the Arab world.
Very quickly, early this year, there was an article from Mother Jones about the Muslim Brotherhood, and mentioned that the Ayatollah Khomeini's mentor was actually a Brotherhood member, part of the Iranian branch at that time.
Oh, Azam, yeah. Azam was the guy who led the freedom fighters into Afghanistan.
Well, he was Osama bin Laden's mentor, but it mentioned that Ayatollah Khomeini's mentor, you know, the original, the head of the Islamic government that took over Iran in 79, had also been Muslim Brotherhood.
Yes, there are amazing crosslinks. I think what happens is when you get to the ultra right, you find all these connecting threads among them.
Bank al-Taqwa is a Muslim Brotherhood function headed up by a World War II Nazi, Youssef Nada.
Youssef Nada, yeah.
But one of its people, Ahmed Huber, himself a protege of Johann von Leers, in charge of anti-Semitic propaganda for the Third Reich, later changed his name to Omar Amin von Leers, became a Muslim, worked for Nasser. But Ahmed Huber, who's also very close to both American and European neo-Nazis, he's very close to the Ayatollahs in Iran. So he represents a breach.
You know, it's funny. Someone just sent me, my predecessor at Justice Department many years ago was a guy by the name of John Rogge, R-O-G-G-E,
mm-hmm.
and he wrote this wonderful book, the Government Report on Fascism or something, and he has a special section in the back on fascism in the Arab world. It's astonishing. He wrote about how some of the American fascist leaders were collaborating with the Germans and stirring up the Arabs and, you know, fomenting all these problems. And it's absolutely amazing to see the incidents going on in the late 40s and the 50s that exactly foreshadow the kind of bigotry, anti-Semitism, anti-Americanism that goes on today. It's as if Hitler was alive again and Goebbels was learned to speak Arabic.
In For the Record program 475, I talked about John Rogge. And interestingly enough, he was fired from his position as head in the Justice Department by Ramsey Clark's father, Tom Clark, mm-hmm. because Ramsey Clark is now an advocate for some of the worst elements in the Islamic world. And it's an interesting bit of a generational relationship. John, we're talking about the Muslim Brotherhood. We should perhaps stress, too, that Hezbollah uses, as I mentioned briefly, Hezbollah uses the Nazi salute. I've got a bunch of wire service
Nazi
photos of them.
And Nazi propaganda. The old Nazi thing, the protocol for the Elders of Zion,
mm-hmm.
That's being utilized as 100% legitimate. This old fraud, which even the original Soviet authors have denounced as a fraud, is being recircled in the Arab world. It's being shown on and dramatized in TV and radio plays. It's just sad. The old Nazi hate propaganda is alive and well in the Arab world.
You know,
please don't condemn all Arabs for this. Not all Arabs are fascists or neo-Nazis, and most of them are moderate and despise these hateful heretics as much as we do.
Well, one of the things, and the same is true of Muslims around the world, one of the things that, I take a lot of heat for talking about Islamic fascism. Bush mentioned that recently, and I've voted against people named George Bush six times now. But the fact of the matter
Listen, I think he's a nice guy. He reads his speeches well. He's definitely better than his father and grandfather.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's no secret that I would have prosecuted his grandfather and great-grandfather as traitors for their support to Hitler. I think the president's a nice guy. Maybe he's not the sharpest tool in the shed,
mm-hmm.
but the people around him scare the heck out of me.
Well, one of the interesting things is, though, is that when I try to talk to people, and I talk about the Grand Mufti, I talk about François Janoux, a very important person who was very close to the Iranian regime. In fact, François Janoux financed Ayatollah Khomeini's exile in France.
Is that right? It was Janoux that did that?
Janoux did that, and also one of his protégés, a guy named Baudin Dunant, who was not only a protege of his, but represented him legally and was a close personal friend. He is co-chairman of the board of directors of SECO, the Saudi investment company.
Oh,
and was liquidating a whole bunch of old financial entities going back to Iran-Contra in the run-up to September 11th. I'll send you some information about that.
Yeah, and people don't realize that the Saudis were on the Hitler's side during World War II.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? It was the only neutral nation that got lend-lease assistance from the U.S., but that's because we were bribing the Saudis into stop selling oil to Hitler. Didn't work, but we gave it a good shot. The Saudis were pro-Nazi. No ifs, ands, or buts about it.
And still are. They hired an American neo-Nazi named William Grimstead as their Washington Washington lobbyist in the late 1990s, so this is nothing that was way in the past. You know, when we talk about people like, you know, François Genoux or the Grand Mufti or Hassan Abbas, a lot of people's eyes roll. But I've shown some pictures of Hezbollah giving the Nazis salute to various people, including people who aren't particularly politicized. And their response has been, oh, God. They grasp it immediately. So those are powerful images.
Exactly. And the thing is, some of my dear friends at CIA,
mm-hmm.
you know, there was a clue what's up, their eyes rolling. Bob Baer wrote a good book called The Sleeping with the Devil.
It's great. I read it.
But there's one paragraph in Bob's book where he talks about how he went to the CIA files to look and see what they had in the Muslim Brotherhood. And there's only a few newspaper clips and stuff. It was almost nothing. And I said, Bob, you don't realize it. They've purged the files. There were volumes and volumes of information. The Muslim Brotherhood was a Nazi intelligence organization that the British Secret Service protected after World War II, and the British sold them to the CIA. When the Egyptian government threw them out in the early 50s, it was the CIA that relocated the Muslim Brotherhood to Saudi Arabia,
mm-hmm.
because the Saudis were the most pro-Nazi state in the Middle East. Now, the Saudis gave the Muslim Brotherhood leaders jobs as school teachers. So you literally had World War II Nazis teaching young men like Osama bin Laden.
Mm-hmm.
So you had this perfect storm where the theological storm, the heresy of Wahhabism, collided with the racist storm of Nazism, and they melded. That is where I believe where modern terrorism came from, was that this collision in the 1950s between these two forces. And that is what gave us birth today to these extreme Islamic groups today.
Absolutely. And again, Ayatollah Khomeini, an old man, and when his exile, according to an article in the San Francisco Chronicle of March 12, 2002, his exile was paid for by François Genoux, the heir to the political last will and testament and collective literary works of Adolf Hitler, Martin Bormann, and Joseph Goebbels, which is quite an interesting cocktail.
Who you mentioned, he was a guy that was with the Muslim Brotherhood in the early days, was an outright Nazi, and now he funds Osama bin Laden.
Mm-hmm. Well, he denies that, but of course the guy who maintained that account for Bank Al-Qaeda conveniently died a month after his name became public. John, you've spoken in the past, we've spoken in the past, and you've written extensively in not only Secret War Against the Jews, but also on Holy Trinity, about Western corporations and transnational corporations, which go back before most people realize, and the Webb-Pomeroy Act, and how really, in a sense, the growth of European fascism could be called something of an outgrowth of the Webb-Pomeroy Act and globalization.
Sure.
I wonder if you'd just encapsulate that briefly for us in the last 5 minutes or so of this side, because there have been some very interesting articles in even the mainstream press talking about how the Muslim Brotherhood is being similarly viewed by certain transnational corporations. A Webb-Pomeroy Act and the funding of fascism.
Okay. Well, people say that history is biography. I think history is economy. There were a group of, they called them the robber barons of Wall Street that raped America in the 1800s. When the 1900s came in, Teddy Roosevelt passed a series of laws outlawing trusts, cartels, monopolies, couldn't do it. Now, the robber barons had one last loophole law that they managed to get through Congress, the Webb-Pomeroy Act of 1918. And this act said, well, you can't have cartels, trusts, and monopolies in America, but it's okay to have them overseas. So during the 1920s, the Wall Street lawyers, the Dulles brothers, took all of the American investment in the capital, and they bought up every corporation in Germany for a song. These guys weren't really supporters of Hitler. They actually liked the Catholic conservative parties better. But, you know, Hitler was a dog on a chain to keep the labor unions down, keep the communists at bay. So the Webb-Pomeroy Act provided the economic incentive for the Americans to quietly take the shattered German nation, buy up all their corporations, and make them a front company, if you will, for the handful of Wall Street firms. And we're talking a tiny portion of our population, but a huge percentage of our wealth. I mean, these are guys like Nelson Rockefeller, DuPont. 70% of the capital that went to rebuild Nazi Germany came from Wall Street.
Mm-hmm. And basically, they did a similar thing in Japan as well. We had this huge boom in World War I in the 1920s, only the profits from that were largely invested in European and Japanese fascism, and that's one of the reasons why it became so powerful and swept all over Europe and Asia. It was the recycled capital from the American industrial boom invested in strategic heavy industry.
I'm going to have my first novel is going to come out next spring with a friend of mine, Brendan Howley of Canada. And it's on this subject. I'm going to be talking about a young woman named Eleanor Dulles. One brother eventually became head of CIA, the other Secretary of State under Eisenhower.
Both partners in Sullivan and Cromwell.
Yeah. But in the 30s, when they were partners in Sullivan and Cromwell, these are the guys that financed Hitler. They moved the money into the Third Reich. Now, Eleanor was married to a Jew, and her husband committed suicide under very suspicious circumstances. Eleanor became a spy for the Zionists, ended up getting the blackmail information on Nelson Rockefeller's financial dealings with the Nazis, and that blackmail enabled the Zionists to get the extra votes in the UN to create the State of Israel. It's a true story. It's never been told before. The title of the book will be The Witness Tree, and it's going up for auction, the Frankfurt Book Fair this October, so cross your fingers. I think it will be a fun read.
And so you're publishing it as novel form, basically, to circumvent...
Fictionless list. The dialogue is fictional, but the story is fact.
Excellent. Well, remarkable. I'll make a point of promoting that as well. One of the things that I'd like to broach on the second side, and we'll open up the subject here and then explore it at great length. There have been a number of articles, specifically a month or two ago, I think it was actually in late May, article in Newsweek/MSNBC about how Islamists and the multinationals are on the same page economically, and specifically their agenda is seen as absolutely consistent with globalization and privatization, and no less an authority then the World Bank views Ibn Khaldun, the Muslim Brotherhood's economic mentor, as the first advocate of privatization. And what I'd like to do on Inside 2 would be to kick that around. And if you think that there might be something of an analogy between the transnationals' attitudes towards European fascism in the World War II period and some of their ambivalence, if we could call it that, towards the Brotherhood. But let's explore that Inside 2. John, your website, Intelligence Summit, terrorfreeintelligencesummit.org, and your website, your homepage is
john-loftus.com, and terrorfreeoil.com is our new project.
So is that, it's all one word and all lowercase, terrorfreeoil.com?
Yep. Yeah, it's not case sensitive, whichever one you want. Yeah.
Alrighty, so those are three websites for people to check out for further information about that, and please, here in California where everybody drives, they drive around the corner. But if you're going to drive, try to find a terror-free oil outlet and do it that way. You know, if you haven't got biodiesel or one of those other things. We've been visiting with John Loftus. This concludes side one of For the Record program number 564. Interview with John Loftus, subtitled, He Who Tells the Truth Gets Chased Out of Nine Villages. For John Loftus, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.